Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
In Thailand, voters say yes to a new government and no to the military.
The sentiment of the era has changed, and it's ripe.
The prime minister-elect says the Thai people have had enough of military rule, but will the army accept the results? Also, an election in Turkey where a lot of people were hoping for change. This voter said the reign of the Sultan, a reference to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is going to end. It still might, but not before a runoff election 2 weeks from now. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Parisians used to be able to swim in the Seine. That ended a century ago because of pollution. Come summer 2024 in the Paris Olympics, though,
it will be a marvelous stage and a place and venue.
Cleaning up the Seine and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. This weekend, big elections in Thailand and Turkey. Today, we're talking results. In Turkey, supporters of a challenge to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's long hold on power. They are disappointed. The opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu promised a return to democracy. He did not lose, but he performed below expectations. And that has set the stage for a tense runoff in 2 weeks. The World's Duri Buskarin begins our coverage from Istanbul.
Going into the election, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu seemed to have the wind at his back. Independent polls showed him in the lead. Rampant inflation and devastating earthquakes in the south had left voters angry.
Recep Tayyip Erdoğan'a karşı bir tek meydan okudu.
Until now, there's been no candidate who can stand up to Erdoğan, said a voter named Dilek as she left the polls on Sunday.
Artık bu sultanın hükümdarlığın yıkılacağını düşünüyorum o yüzden.
I really think the reign of the Sultan is going to end, she said. But she asked not to share her last name because her family was pressuring her to vote for Erdoğan.
Aile, öyle söyleyeyim, ailem öbür tarafa verdiğimi düşünüyorum.
Erdoğan's campaign focused on national security, pressing military vessels into service for campaign events. He accused the opposition of supporting LGBT rights, which galvanized conservative voters.
Erdoğan kaybederse,
in a wealthy district of Istanbul, 75-year-old Tuncay Turan says he sees Erdoğan as the best candidate to keep Turkey safe from the pressures of the West.
Türkiye'siz, Tayyip'siz kesebilirler.
Without Tayyip, Turan says, Turkey could be split into pieces. At the same polling place, a tech worker named Cihan Peker said Erdoğan has dominated Turkish politics for 20 years, giving the opposition few opportunities to develop an identity of its own.
Because we had to always gather against his very autocratic and populist and very conservative religious push.
And after a campaign marked by violent attacks on opposition rallies and the arrests of Kurdish activists, journalists and lawyers, Peker left the polls feeling anxious.
And of course we have concerns about election safety, about what could happen afterwards. But I think this time it's going to happen. If not, I think dark days are waiting for us.
A whopping 88% of Turkish voters participated in this election. But last night, the streets of Istanbul were silent as people hunkered down at home, watching the results come in. The first vote counts released on state-affiliated TV showed Erdoğan with a comfortable lead over Kılıçdaroğlu.
Biz buradayız. Birazdan, Millet İttifakı'nın...
Every couple hours, opposition leaders held press conferences, insisting that the results from pro-Erdoğan districts were being released first, manipulating the early vote counts to look better for Erdoğan. Ballots are counted by hand in Turkey, in the presence of observers. Ceren Salman was one of them, representing a pro-Kurdish opposition party in central Istanbul.
Just as soon as voting ends, there's suddenly three people appearing at the door, walk into the room without even really, like, identifying themselves.
Salman says they were ballot observers for the ruling party, and in her case, they didn't interfere.
It was just unpleasant that they just showed up after everything ended to then try and kind of influence the vibe of the room while counting was happening.
At other polling places, pro-Erdogan observers made repeated objections to vote counts, forcing recounts and delaying the release of the numbers. But by morning, the results were clear. Erdogan had at least a 4-point lead over Kılıçdaroğlu. But neither candidate received more than 50% of the vote, setting the stage for a runoff election in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Erdogan's party and ultranationalist allies received a majority in parliament.
Support for Kılıçdaroğlu dropped in Turkey's middle-income regions and rural and small-town areas, and perhaps it's not going to pick up.
Soner Çaptay directs the Turkish research program at the Washington Institute. Now, Çaptay says the opposition is demoralized, and Kılıçdaroğlu is facing a headwind. 4 points is a lot to pick up when Erdogan controls the government and can use it to his advantage.
It is a taller order for him than it is for Erdogan.
But in a video today, Kılıçdaroğlu refused to give up.
Buradayım ve buradayım. Siz de buradasınız.
I'm here, you're here too, I will fight to the end, he says as he slams his hand on the desk. I am here. Turkish voters will head to the polls again for a runoff vote on May 28th. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin in Istanbul.
Another election over the weekend in Thailand brought a big surprise. Voters delivered a message to the military-backed government. They want the army to step back from politics. Thailand's military has long kept a tight grip on any government in power, but a new progressive party promising to end the, quote, dictatorship won Sunday's election in a landslide. Now many voters are wondering if the military will really let its rivals run the country. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok.
There's a sense of joy here in Thailand, at least among the majority who voted for change. A crowd of Thai voters chanting, "Prime Minister, Prime Minister," while gleefully mobbing a man named Pita Limjaroenrat. 42-year-old Pita is a Harvard grad with a Hollywood smile. He was CEO of a tech company that's sort of like Uber, but now he's the leader of a political party called Gaoglai, which means move forward, as in taking a giant step away from what he calls dictatorship. The Move Forward party swept this election. So Pita says he'll be the next prime minister of Thailand, replacing Prayut Chan-o-cha, a stalwart army man who seized power 9 years ago in a coup. Here's Pita earlier today.
The sentiment of the era has changed, and it's right. It was the right timing that people have been through enough.
The Move Forward party is a mix of activists and intellectuals and young business elites, and they are the bane of Thailand's military. They promise to slash the military budget and get rid of the draft, and they're even challenging the ultimate taboo in Thailand by pushing to change laws surrounding the royal family. Thai citizens are taught from kindergarten that their monarchy is the pinnacle of society and that the military is its great protector. Anyone who criticizes the king or queen can go to prison for more than 10 years. Pita says, let's make that a lesser offense. The conventional wisdom was any politician questioning the monarchy's role would be rejected by Thai voters. But Move Forward's landslide calls that into question. I asked Kriyengsak Jeroenwongsak, a political scholar and former lawmaker, if the military saw this coming.
I don't think they think that they're going to lose so badly. It was beyond their expectation, and they're caught by surprise.
Move Forward has been portrayed in the media as kind of radical. Pita was seen as a darling for the young, hip city crowd, but not someone who could sweep the board. But he did. So now Move Forward and the second most popular party, Pheutai, which is also anti-military, plans to run the country as a coalition, with Pita as prime minister.
Legitimately, he has the right to form the government, but...
But, Professor Kriyengsak says, because in Thai politics, there's often a but.
Knowing Thailand and the situation surrounding this whole campaign, it could be very difficult for him to be prime minister.
After the last coup, Thailand's military junta installed a few firewalls, just in case future voters ever picked someone they really don't like. In Thailand's parliament, which chooses the prime minister, one-third of the lawmakers are unelected, handpicked by the military establishment. And so is the election commission, Its members can disqualify parties the military finds threatening. But if Pita Limjaroenrat gets disqualified, all that hope his supporters have invested in him to change the system could turn to anger. Again, here's Professor Kriyengsak.
Street riots that could really end up in a messy situation. So I'm very worried. I want peace. I no longer would like to see a coup d'etat.
Another coup d'etat is always possible. Over the years, Thailand has had 20 military coups. It is a long-running cycle, and it's one that many Thais wanted to end by voting for change. For the World, Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
In East Africa, as we've been reporting for months now, drought has been deadly for humans and also, as we learned this weekend, for wildlife. In Kenya, the arid conditions have drawn hungry lions much closer to places where people live. The result of these close encounters? In the past week alone, herders have killed 10 lions as they try to defend their own livestock from lion attacks. On Saturday, one of the lions killed was Kenya's oldest, known as Lunkito. The Kenya Wildlife Service said that it was frail and had wandered out of the Amboseli National Park into a village in search of food. Ecologist Robert Montgomery runs several programs that research the tension between humans and lions across East Africa. He's at the University of Oxford in the UK. Robert, there have been two of these incidents in the past week in Kenya. How bad do conditions have to get for the lions to start wandering into villages?
The conditions don't have to be particularly bad at all. I mean, these are coupled human and natural systems where pastoralists have kept livestock alongside lions hunting wild prey for thousands of years. The situation in the present day is exacerbated by climate change and seasonal dimensions, but these are species that are accustomed to encountering one another on a daily basis.
What has the Kenya Wildlife Service said or done about the current situation?
They've responded dynamically by meeting with the local livestock owners to understand the severity of the situation and try to develop solutions when this conflict arises. Among those solutions are early alert systems. So various members of the livestock communities, that the livestock owners that actually communicate with Kenya Wildlife Service to alert them in instances in which they've lost livestock.
Is there kind of an equilibrium at play, or is it a relationship of constant conflict?
Well, one of the things that we're looking into in my research laboratory is whether the cultural fabric and heritage of the local communities historically has offered solutions for the ways in which to reduce human-lion conflict. And it's quite possible that in the present day, much of that cultural legacy has been lost because elders are passing away and that information is not always being passed on to the next generation.
What are some of the elements of that cultural legacy that have been lost?
A lot of the tribes in the East African region were pastoralists in the sense that they were constantly moving. Constantly moving was a means of actually decreasing the probability of encountering species like lions that could kill your livestock. But in the modern day, particularly with the establishment of protected areas, a lot of the historic pastoral practices have changed to the point where people have established long-term areas where they've set up villages and bomas, again, these livestock corrals where they keep their animals at night. That means that the locations where these livestock are located become more predictable to the lions over time.
What more can you tell us about Lunkito, reportedly Kenya's oldest lion? How well was this one lion known in Kenya?
Very well known. It was an excellent example of the Kenya Wildlife Service and Lion Guardians, a non-governmental organization that were seeking to develop sustainable solutions for human-lion conflict. The fact that Lunkito had gotten to the age of 19 is rather exceptional in the modern day, given that it's rare for lions to be over the age of 13, 14, or 15. So Lunkito was a special animal that was a symbol of conservation success.
So what we're seeing happening in Kenya, I mean, are similar conditions and pressures emerging in other parts of the continent?
Absolutely. Human-lion conflict is a massive problem throughout the range of lions, both in sub-Saharan Africa and in the last remaining populations in India. It's one of the primary threats, including all the others that I mentioned, prey depletion and habitat fragmentation, etc., that threaten the very survivability and conservation of lions across their range. So it's a very big issue indeed.
Robert Montgomery is a professor of ecology at the University of Oxford in the UK, speaking with us about the environmental conditions that have drawn Kenya's lions into dangerous proximity with humans, danger for lions and for people. Robert, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The U.S., as you probably know, is the largest supplier of weapons to defend Ukraine. It's also led the effort to stop global weapons deliveries to Russia. In December, South Africa may have been involved in an incident that violated sanctions imposed by Washington. The U.S. ambassador to South Africa, Ruben Brigady, recently spoke about a ship, the Lady R, docked in Cape Town.
We are confident that weapons were loaded onto that vessel, and I would bet my life on the accuracy of that assertion.
In other words, the U.S. ambassador is very confident weapons in South Africa were loaded onto that Russian boat. Reporter Peter Fabricius covers diplomacy for South Africa's The Daily Maverick. Peter, some background here. What is known about the Russian ship, the Lady R, and its docking in Cape Town last December?
What we do know is that the ship docked and loaded and or unloaded material in the dead of night. You know, it was a very clandestine operation. And that, of course, created the suspicion that, you know, either we were buying or we were selling arms to or from Russia.
So you're saying stuff was either loaded or unloaded from this vessel, but no evidence that any of this stuff was weapons?
No. You know, there's been one kind of suggestion from the defense minister that perhaps we unloaded ammunition, you know, Russian-made ammunition for our special forces. But the real question here is what, if anything, was uploaded onto the ship?
Well, this has been a hot topic now for several months, so hot that South Africa sent a delegation to Washington last week to ease tensions, which brings us to Ambassador Brigady's remarks last Thursday. What was the reaction there in South Africa when Ambassador Brigady called out South Africa and essentially accused it of supplying weapons to Russia?
Yeah, there was a huge reaction, actually. Diplomatically, he was called in by the foreign minister. He was demarched, as they put it in diplomatic speak. He supposedly apologized unreservedly, according to the South African Department of International Relations, for crossing the line. But he himself has just said that he clarified his statement and any misimpression that it might have caused.
Is his sense that the ambassador went rogue, or was he delivering a message from the State Department in Washington?
Yeah, you know, that is an unknown question, and there are people on both sides of that argument. My own impression is that I doubt that he would have gone beyond what, you know, the State Department wanted him to say. You know, he had just been in Washington for about a week or so at the same time as a delegation from the South African government. So he must have known what his government was thinking.
It's not the only problem the U.S. has had with South Africa's stated neutrality over the war in Ukraine. South Africa welcomed China and Russia to participate in naval war games.
Yeah.
What's been the reaction among South Africans to all of this?
You know, South Africans are very sharply divided about this whole issue of the war in Ukraine. The ANC government are quite strongly behind Russia. You know, the ANC governing party believes that basically this war was caused by the US and NATO because of the expanding boundaries up to the borders of Russia. And on the other side of the fence, the opposition, Democratic Alliance opposition, very firmly behind Ukraine. So it's a very divisive issue in this country.
Peter, what do you think is ahead then for US-South Africa relations? What does this moment represent?
You know, my sense is that neither side really wants to, at the administration level, to break off this relationship. I mean, it's quite important economically. And so when Mufamadi, who is President Ramaphosa's national security advisor, got back from this mission to the U.S. and spoke about it on Saturday, he was at pains to give the impression that the issue has been resolved. Of course, I think that's pushing it a little bit, because we're going to have an inquiry now into this Lady R incident and whether it loaded arms, and quite a lot might depend on the outcome of that.
Peter Fabricius is a reporter with South Africa's The Daily Maverick. Thanks very much, Peter. Thanks for helping us understand this better.
Sure. Okay.
When Paris hosted the Summer Olympics way back in 1900, swimming events were held in the evocative river, the Seine. By 1923, Paris banned swimming in the river due to high levels of pollution. Now with the 2024 Summer Olympics coming up, officials want to make the Seine swimmable again. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The Seine became contaminated over the years from nearby industrial work, untreated sewage water, and Parisians using it as a dumping ground for bikes and other trash.
It was relatively bad when we started.
Dan Angelesco is the CEO of a water monitoring company called Fluidian. He's been tracking the river's water quality for City Hall ever since 2017, when Paris won its bid to host the Games.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Pierre Rabidan is the deputy mayor leading the city's preparation for the Games and the river's cleanup. He says the project starts upstream, outside of city limits. That's where 23,000 houses are disconnected from the main sewer system and are dumping their wastewater right into the Seine.
We have to transform it one by one.
Rabadan says his team has so far reconfigured 8,000 of those houses. Now, their wastewater will be properly treated before it's dumped into the Seine and makes its way to Paris. Structures within the city have been updated too, including improving nearby water treatment factories and connecting Paris-based houseboats to the sewer system. But perhaps the biggest solution is happening underground in a rainwater storage tank.
We create a big hole, equivalent of 20 Olympic swimming pool of water. That's the capacity.
Rabadan says this massive underground tank is essential to controlling the sewer system during rainstorms, when the deluge of excess water overwhelms the water treatment plants. Angelesco, the water quality expert, explains.
These pools are made to collect all this water that comes out at once, and then from there it's pumped slowly to the wastewater plants when the rain stops. That way it can basically treat all the coming water at a rate that it can deal with.
Angelesco says the river has gotten cleaner since 2017, but this major underground infrastructure is still being built, so the Seine's water quality still worsens after significant rainfall.
And hopefully one day we'll stop seeing that, and that's going to be a really great achievement.
It's a pricey bet. Officials estimate the project will cost more than $1.5 billion. Rabadan says it's worth it, as the Seine will serve as the venue for Olympic triathlon and distance swimming events.
It will be a marvelous stage and a place and venue for this competition in the heart of the city.
Locals will also reap the benefits long after the Olympics. Officials hope to open sections of the river for public swimming in 2025.
People are very happy about going swimming in the Seine.
Guy Hervier leads the Neptune Club, a large swim club in Paris.
We have open water swimmers, and they are competing in, you know, lakes around Paris or any place in France. And I'm sure they will be very happy to do that in the Seine.
I ask Hervier if he plans to jump in himself.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I'm not sure.
He says he actually did swim in the Seine once, and it was so murky he couldn't see his hand when it was right under the surface. So he's hesitant.
Maybe I'll do it. I'm not sure.
Rabadan says he knows the city will have to educate Parisians, who have all grown up with a dirty Seine making swimming impossible.
So we have to convince and explain what we did for making that possible.
There are also plans to give the public access to water quality data so they can see how clean the water is themselves. Rabadan says 75% of the cleanup will be finished this summer, just in time for brave swimmers to compete in Olympic test events in the Seine. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Sudanese American schoolchildren are half a world away from the fighting that is tearing apart their country, but they can still feel the effects of the conflict.
I can tell on my parents' face like how terrified they are. Every single day, like my mom's calling, I'm trying to send them money over, and it's just like really terrifying.
Also, while the U.S. sounds alarm bells about the dangers of AI, Europe cracks down. Ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A little over a year ago, the British government launched a plan to help Ukrainian refugees, pair them with families in the UK, and pay those families to house them. That assistance has benefited more than 100,000 Ukrainians. Now one of the players behind the Homes for Ukraine program is calling on his government to create a similar scheme for people fleeing the fighting in Sudan. That person is Krish Kandia, the director of the UK charity Sanctuary Foundation. Krish, tell us more about why you're asking the British government to really step up and do for Sudanese people what they did for Ukrainians fleeing that war.
Well, we've seen an amazing response from the UK public. Over 170,000 Ukrainian refugees are living with ordinary folk like me and my family. Initially, they were asked to offer 6 months of hospitality in their homes. But for many, many families, it's been well over a year now. At the moment, our asylum system is closing down, actually. There's something called the Illegal Migration Bill that's going through the Parliament, and that's going to make it very, very difficult for anyone to claim asylum in the UK. But the government has consistently said that they want to patrol our borders, stop the boats, and they want to offer safe and legal routes. And so here we have a perfect opportunity for them to do just that through emulating the hospitality shown to Ukrainians and offering that same hospitality to Sudanese people.
Have you been finding similar willingness on the part of British families, non-Sudanese expat families, to house Sudanese?
Well, it's been nothing like the response that we saw for Ukraine. When we opened our website, 29,000 people came forward in a week before there was a government program. So it hasn't been anything like that. I think partly because even though the fighting seemed to be intensifying in Sudan, I was in Aswan in Egypt at the weekend just meeting Sudanese people. And they were telling me horrible stories of bombs being dropped just near their homes. They had to flee and try to make a really long journey and get to Egypt with literally just the clothes on their back. So it's really terrible, but it's not in the news in the same way that Ukraine was at the beginning or even is now. But interestingly, yes, I think we've probably seen of the 120 or so people that have come forward, it's probably 70 that are from Sudan and 50 are from the UK.
Fair to say, after the time you spent in Aswan in Egypt, that the urgency in Sudan is pretty dire right now, yes?
It is. People are running out of food. There's no food in the shops. Some of the shops have been looted. People can't even access their money because the banks are looted and the online banking's offline because the internet's down. So that's why people need to get out of the country. There's about 75,000 have crossed the border into Egypt. And the interesting thing for me is hardly anybody from Sudan wants to come to the United Kingdom. The vast majority of Sudanese, just like most refugees, they want to stay close. They either want to stay in the country and become internally displaced people, or they want to stay in surrounding countries where they speak the language. The culture is very similar. So we're only asking for a very small number to come to the UK, and that tends to be people that have a familial link or a cultural link with the United Kingdom.
Bottom line, Chris, do you think we'll see a Homes for Sudan program the way we saw the Homes for Ukraine program that you were part of?
I think ethically, morally, and even historically, I mean, the UK is part of the reason there's a problem in Sudan. We drew the borders. We used to be the colonial rulers of that country, and we are actually the pen holders at the United Nations for Sudan. So ethically, morally, historically, we ought to do this. And I really want to believe that the government is going to honour its promise. It will create safe and legal routes. I've done my part. Really, it's up to the government now to make it possible.
Krish Kandia is the director of the UK charity Sanctuary Foundation. Krish, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
According to the UN, more than 150,000 people have fled Sudan since fighting broke out a month ago. Here in the U.S., Sudanese Americans are feeling the trauma. Hana Baba is a Sudanese-American journalist in San Francisco. She also volunteers at a Sudanese Sunday school there, and recently she's had to address the war with the children in her class, who range in age from 9 to 14.
I've been teaching our community kids for years about Sudan's history, some geography. We talk about food, music, we play games, tell folk tales. We have a lot of fun. Right now, we have an end-of-year show that we've got to rehearse for. Each kid will be representing one of Sudan's 18 states
confidence,
on stage.
When I say Blue Nile State, and then there's going to be a music of Blue Nile State, and then Omar Tijani is going to walk up and read his paragraph.
But there's something else I have to do today. Since war broke out in Sudan on April 15th, there's no way around it. All their parents are talking about is the violence back home, the displacement of their families. So I knew we had to talk about the war in class. To do that, I needed some professional help. I called up my pediatrician friend, Dr. Selma Al-Faki, to get some pointers.
I would ask open-ended question at first. Okay, guys, how are you today? So I know many of you may have heard that something's going on in Sudan. What do you guys know?
Selma is Sudanese. She, too, is helping family back home to evacuate. She's used to talking to kids about anxiety and fear, something I haven't done in class before.
Once you get that information, maybe ask them, how does this make you feel? What are you worried about?
We're going to take the first 10-ish minutes to talk about what's happening to Sudan, just to get a check on how everybody's feeling.
I don't want any family to die, because then my family would be sad, and that would be, like, not good. So, like, I guess worried.
I'm feeling worried because my uncle, he evacuated his family and he came back. And so he's just staying over there. Like, he gathered, like, people from the neighborhood and now they're all staying in the house. But I'm still kind of worried because I've seen, like, videos and stuff of, like, near our house, Philadelphia. So I'm kind of scared.
These kids had a lot to say. It's as if they were waiting to be asked.
So I can tell on my parents' face, like, how terrified they are and how worried. And, like, every single day, like, my mom's calling to make sure they, like, can, that they're okay and stuff. And, like, they're trying to get buses to Egypt. I'm trying to send them money over, and it's just, like, really terrifying. I've never, like, experienced something like this. So, like, I can't really do anything.
That helplessness that last girl Anne talks about, that takes me to the next tip Dr. Selma gave me, service.
You know, maybe try to see, well, how can we make ourselves feel better and help Sudan? And they may brainstorm.
You could start, like, a fundraiser and, like, do certain things, like sell stuff for people to donate.
And we can protest.
Protest! Because protest does what? What does protest do, Lema?
It spreads awareness.
Right.
Even, like, close friends of mine don't even know what's happening in Sudan, so, like, spreading awareness can really help a lot. And, like, I feel like spreading awareness, like, can really change what's happening there and can help a lot of families there, because other people probably, like, don't think it's that important. Like, it's, oh, it's just another war.
They had some great ideas and some interesting ones, like annoying senators by yelling outside their offices.
And then they'll be like, okay, let me go call Joe Biden and tell him what's going on. And then Joe Biden might be like, all right, let's help them. And then Joe Biden might, like, become friends with one of them and then, like, end the war.
Dr. Selma says something that's important for self-esteem and identity is to remind them about the good things, the beauty of the country, that it's not just a war-ravaged homeland. And she gives the example of how to talk about Port Sudan, now known as the city where thousands are stranded awaiting evacuation by sea.
It's beautiful. It has, you know, it's the Red Sea. It's by the actual Red Sea because it has corals and there's shipwrecks and all kinds of cool stuff.
And finally, she says, yes, it's important to get them talking about how they feel about the war, but only for some time. Don't prolong it, she says. Getting back to the routine is key to relieving anxiety and worry. So for us today, that means enough war talk and back to regular class. We have a big day coming up, our end of year celebration. We gotta rehearse.
Who does not know what their state is? We need to be like,
as I look around the class, I'm hoping today's chat helps them cope with the madness of grown-ups tearing up their parents' country in war. But for now, in this moment, we gotta try to get back to normal, or as close to normal as we can get.
Where the two Niles meet is known as El Mugren or El Mugren. Yeah, from there, the Nile continues north toward Egypt and the Mediterranean.
For the world, I'm Hanat Baba in San Francisco.
Today, for the first time ever, the United Nations observed the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes 75 years ago. For Palestinians, the event is known as the Nakba, meaning catastrophe in Arabic. It coincided with the UN partition plan that brought about the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Israelis and many others see the events differently. For Israel, it marks their successful war for independence when five Arab countries attacked the territory, hoping to prevent the Jewish state from forming. Today, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas led the Nakba commemoration at UN headquarters in New York. Here's Abbas speaking through an interpreter.
Nakba, ladies and gentlemen, did not start in 1948. And it did not stop after that date.
U.S. officials stayed away from the commemoration. The Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, said the event was, quote, despicable and a blatant attempt to distort history. The resolution to recognize the 75th anniversary was passed last November, with 90 countries voting in favor, 30 against, and another 47 nations abstaining. More than a year of war has changed Ukraine forever. It's also reshaping Russia. Opinions around the globe are starkly divided on what should happen to Russia after the conflict in Ukraine ends. President Vladimir Putin is, of course, hoping his nation's borders will be expanded and his own grip on power will be strengthened. Many outside Russia are pushing for a future without Putin, a future in which Moscow will never again be in a position to invade its neighbors. Some Russians themselves are calling for a restructuring of their country and reconsidering Russian national identity, proposals that often bring great personal risk. From Brussels, Theo Mertz has that story.
Alexandra Garmazhapova is enjoying a pastry and coffee in a Brussels cafe. Given that she's on Russia's wanted list and believes Putin's agents might try to poison her, she's fairly relaxed. If she ever tried to go back to Russia, she'd be arrested as soon as she lands, she says. Moscow put out this warrant at the start of the year over her work with a group calling for greater autonomy for Buryatia, her native region of Siberia. She's one of a number of ethnic minority activists who are using the conflict in Ukraine to highlight racism within Russia and fight Moscow's top-down rule of the country. About 70% of Russians are ethnically Slavic, but the country is also home to almost 200 other ethnic groups, like Buryats, who have historically been badly treated. Garmazhapova says it's absurd for Putin to call himself an anti-fascist and say that he invaded Ukraine to fight Nazism there. He's the xenophobe in chief, she says. He's a chauvinist who has proudly described himself for years as a Russian nationalist. The president often talks about Russia's multi-ethnic makeup, but in reality, authorities have long targeted ethnic minority activists and tried to limit the teaching of minority languages. Thousands of miles from the capital, Buryatia is one of Russia's poorest regions. It has historic ties to Mongolia, but was colonized by Tsarist Russia from the 1600s.
Валик себе в Узбекистан.
Garmazhapova says she would often be told to go home to China or Uzbekistan because of her Asiatic appearance. When that happened, she'd say, actually, I'm a citizen of the Russian Federation. I have the same passport that you do. At the start of the invasion, Garmazhapova's Free Buryatia Foundation helped soldiers from the region escape army contracts and return home. The group said Buryat men were used as cannon fodder as their lives were seen as less valuable, and then they were unfairly blamed for committing the worst atrocities of the war. But bringing soldiers back from the front has become all but impossible under new laws. Now, Garmazhapova is campaigning for genuine local government in Russia, like in the United States or Germany. That dream might be a long way off. Putin has spent the last two decades centralizing power in the Kremlin. Anyone who challenges this in a meaningful way is arrested, forced to flee the country, or in some cases killed. Some ethnic minority activists want to go even further than Garmazhapova. They don't want their regions to be part of the Russian Federation at all. They want to be completely independent. Among them is Raisa Zubarova, an activist from Yakutia, a far eastern region. She now lives in Warsaw.
Россия не должна существовать в том виде, в котором она существует сейчас.
Russia mustn't carry on existing as it is, she tells me. In its current form, it will always be a threat. The mineral resources that provide the money for the military come from regions like hers. Most politicians in the West, she says, are reluctant to publicly back the breakup of Russia, rejecting it as too extreme. But she suggests that if you keep repeating an idea, eventually it will become normalized. Zubarova says she doesn't see a problem with activists like her living outside Russia. If they stay there, they'll be arrested and you can't communicate with the public from prison. Her Free Yakutia Foundation sees its work as informing the public and changing attitudes. Activists might be divided on whether they want independence or just greater autonomy, but they all agree that the war in Ukraine has given them an important opportunity to bring their plight to global attention. They say the invasion has laid bare Russia's imperial mentality, which is not just killing Ukrainians, but also harming ethnic minorities within its own borders. Abubakar Yangulbayev is a human rights lawyer from Chechnya. The region was brutally subjugated by Moscow after fighting for its independence. He now lives in Paris.
After the Russia invaded Ukraine, we started to talk about racism, chauvinism and xenophobia inside Russia. And it's the big problem because in Russia Russia never fought against racism.
Now people are starting to pay attention to what life is actually like for minorities in Russia.
Before, we didn't have enough space. Right now, many of national minorities have resources, have a network.
While Russian society becomes ever more nationalistic as the war drags on, conversations around racism and decentralization are beginning to happen. People from minority groups are increasingly interested in their own cultures and history, these activists say. Whatever the challenges ahead, they believe another Russia is possible. For The World, I'm Theo Mertz in Brussels.
It seems everywhere these days there's daily hand-wringing about the possible dangers of artificial intelligence, or AI, fears of jobs being lost, erosion of privacy, or the bots simply taking over. So far in the U.S., though, we're not hearing much about government regulation of AI. The European Union, on the other hand, seems to be way ahead. Last week, a key committee of EU lawmakers approved a first-of-its-kind set of regulatory measures known as the European AI Act. Sarah Myers-West is the managing director of the AI Now Institute, a policy research institute in New York. Sarah, you live and breathe artificial intelligence and its implications for society. The EU's AI Act, it's not law yet, but in its current form, what do you think it gets right?
Well, it gets a number of things right. I think in the latest draft that we've seen out of the European Parliament, there are a number of prohibitions that place certain types of artificial intelligence in a category of unacceptable risk. They include things like prohibitions on the use of real-time remote biometric identification systems. So that would be, you know, things like using facial recognition in real time in publicly accessible spaces. Prohibitions on using biometrics to identify sensitive characteristics, like trying to use facial recognition to identify your gender or your race or your citizenship status. It also includes bans on things like emotion recognition and some of the most harmful use cases like predictive policing.
Right. So on the surface, it seems like this legislation is aiming to weed out the bad bits of AI from the beneficial aspects. That's admirable, but is it even possible?
It's certainly going to be tricky, and this is one of the elements that has been under the most negotiation as lawmakers have been discussing the AI Act. It uses this classification system where certain types of systems are deemed different levels of risk, from permissible risks to low, high, and then ultimately unpermissible risks. And I think figuring out where systems that are in deployment ultimately fit into these categories is going to be the trickiest parts of enforcing the legislation.
Yes. So from your perspective, Sarah, what is missing from the European Union's AI Act?
It focuses really on the end product that misses some of the decisions that are made far upstream. So by focusing on the system as it's deployed out in the world, you're not necessarily accounting for decisions made on what kind of data is used to train a system. And I think that that's one of the challenges with the approach that the EU has decided to take here.
It feels like it's been a heady month or so in the world of AI, with any number of experts and AI developers saying it's all going too fast, slow down, because if we don't, AI is going to lead to the collapse of human civilization. And so far, Sarah, I'm hearing very few scenarios from those experts as to how that would happen. Do you understand what EU parliamentarians were hearing that got them so alarmed that they wanted to legislate on AI?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the EU has been working on this AI Act for a few years now. It's been in the works much longer than, you know, the current frenzy around artificial intelligence. And that's true in the United States, too. There have been different legal approaches floated to regulating AI long before the sort of alarm around ChatGPT. And I think what's important to remember in both of those instances is that there are a lot of harms done by AI in the here and now, that the fear-mongering about, you know, what's going to happen when the singularity comes tends to ignore. And I think it's those kinds of concerns, you know, how are people being harmed in the here and now, that we need to be focusing on, because AI already is impacting people's ability to get a job, to get a mortgage. Those kinds of uses of AI are a little bit out of the spotlight, but I think are having the greatest impact on real people.
Yeah, walk us through briefly how AI is impacting people, like in their ability to get a job or get a mortgage.
AI is being used to make decisions like whether you're going to get called in for a job interview, for instance, through uses of AI to scan through your resume and identify, right, do you have the kinds of characteristics that we're looking for in this job? It can be used in decision making around healthcare, for instance. One study looked at the use of a system to determine whether or not you were going to get certain kinds of resources when you went to the hospital and found that it was leading people of color to have fewer access to resources in hospitals than other people were. So I think those kinds of uses are the most pressing to be addressing.
Right. So you called the EU's legislation the first such government oversight on artificial intelligence, right? So where does US legislation or thinking on AI compare with what the EU is doing?
Well, I think one really important signal that we've seen came recently from the FTC, the EEOC, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Judiciary Department. They all recently published a notice that they intend to be enforcing existing law. Things like, you know, you can't produce a system that enables fraud at scale, or you can't make misrepresentations about what your product is capable of doing. And it said that those laws apply to artificial intelligence. There's also anti-discrimination law. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has said that, you know, it's been looking very closely into the use of AI in hiring practices and potential for employment discrimination as a result of the use of those systems. Competition law has also been really key here. A lot of the artificial intelligence systems that are in use today can't really exist without massive amounts of resources that only the biggest tech firms have. So antitrust enforcement is going to have a huge effect on AI out in the world.
Sarah Myers-West is the managing director of the AI Now Institute, a policy research institute in New York. Thank you very much, Sarah. Good to speak.
No problem. Have a good one.
Earlier this hour, we told you about elections in Turkey and Thailand, where the results still hang in the balance. There was another vote held this weekend, this one with a clear outcome.
243 points! We have a winner! Sweden! You have won the Eurovision Song Contest 2023! Congratulations to Noreen!
Yep, Eurovision. This year, the annual song contest pitted 37 countries against each other, hoping to win the hearts and ears of official juries and the voting public. The raucous, flamboyant entry from neighboring Finland, Cha-Cha-Cha, made it a close competition. You can check out theworld.org for more about that song, the singer, and his green bolero jacket. In the end, the Swedish singer Loreen was unbeatable. She became the first woman to win Eurovision for a second time. Loreen sets up Sweden to host a contest next year on the 50th anniversary of ABBA winning Eurovision for Sweden. Now that's going to be a party. This year, though, Loreen and her song Tattoo give Sweden plenty to cheer about. World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Yeah.
PRX.